Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Happy New Year! With me this month are Laura Howes, Phil Broadwith and Patrick Walter. They'll be revealing how the espresso you pick up from one cafe could contain 600% more caffeine than an equivalent brew bought elsewhere. Also, how soot has inspired a nano design for self-cleaning glass. And is this the lightest metal substance known to man?
This metallic structure is actually 10% lighter than the lightest aerogels, so it really is an incredibly light material, and the researchers have a great picture on it, which is quite a large piece of the material resting on top of the head of a dandelion.
Hello, this is the Chemistry World Podcast for January 2012, and I'm Chris Smith.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And first up, Patrick is quivering with excitement over this first story. Or perhaps it's just the caffeine.
No, if you're feeling a bit jittery today, then perhaps it's the coffee shop you bought your coffee from. So Alan Crozier at the University of Glasgow did a bit of a field trial. He went around 20 Glaswegian coffee houses and picked up an espresso from each of them. This wasn't just for like a massive coffee hit for one day for him. He had a scientific purpose behind it.
Oh, I'm pleased to hear that. I'm sure the funders of the study will also be equally pleased to hear that their money was being well spent. What does he do with it?
Right, he takes it away. He dilutes it in methanol and freezes it just to preserve it. And then he runs a few HPLC tests. So that's high pressure or high performance liquid chromatography.
Looking for the caffeine. Content.
Exactly. So he was looking for the caffeine content. So what he discovered was quite a massive disparity in the levels of caffeine you find across coffees from different coffee shops.
How big was the disparity?
So it ranged from 50 milligrams to 322 milligrams. It's a massive amount.
300?
322.
So the 600% difference.
Exactly, yeah.
Blimey. And these are all marketed as an espresso.
They're all marketed equivalently. They're all marketed as espressos, and the Food Standards Agency says that people should expect, on average, that an espresso should contain about 50 milligrams of coffee, and really only one actually contained that amount. All the rest had higher amounts.
So who was the best performer? Where should real caffeine heads like me head for in Glasgow?
So best performance depends on whether you're a pregnant woman or a caffeine seeker.
No, but in this case, hopeless addict like me, where would I go for my best hit then?
If you're a hopeless addict, then Patisserie Francois in Glasgow.
Which was the 300 milligram one.
Yep.
And what about if I'm feeling I'm already encaffeinated to the extent of jitteriness? Where should I go then?
Then Starbucks is your one. Only 50 milligrams, apparently.
Okay. So how does this compare then with other recreational uses of caffeine? If I go out to a club and I say, I'll have vodka and Red Bull, and I sink a whole tin of, you know, the small tins of Red Bull, how much caffeine in there for comparison?
Well, oddly enough, a Red Bull, despite being marketed as an energy drink, doesn't contain that much more caffeine than an espresso, 80 milligrams per can.
Wow. So actually, some of these coffees are containing maybe three or four times as much caffeine
exactly.
In one espresso.
You're getting four Red Bulls from maybe 50 mils of liquid.
Gosh, much cheaper to go and buy the coffee then.
Exactly, yes.
So what do these guys say about this in Glasgow?
Well, they do have their concerns. The Food Standards Agency recommends that pregnant women shouldn't have more than 200 milligrams of caffeine per day. This also goes for children, but I don't know many children who drink espresso.
Are they suggesting there should be some kind of regulation then, in the same way that you buy a packet of cigarettes and it says this contains X number of milligrams of nicotine and X number of milligrams of tar? Should we now have high, medium and low tar coffee?
They haven't gone so far as to recommend that. They are recommending sort of further studies. I mean, as they say, it's just 20 coffee shops throughout Glasgow, but they say it probably is something that extrapolates pretty well to the rest of the country. But they're saying more research is obviously needed to assess caffeine levels across a much wider area.
Are there any upsides to having a bigger caffeine hit?
If you have a bigger caffeine hit, then it's likely that the antioxidant levels will be higher. So the Patisserie Francois espresso contained roughly the same level of antioxidants as it did caffeine. And this kind of pattern holds. So the Starbucks one contains a lot less of the antioxidants too.
So a quivering jelly you may be, but protected from oxidative damage you definitely will be too. Phil, too much coffee might also turn you into a zombie. Put us out of our misery.
Yes, Chris. Well, hopefully the zombie that I'm talking about isn't going to try and eat your brains, but it does certainly come back to life. This is a group of Japanese high school students, in fact, who were doing an experiment in class using oscillating reactions, a very famous one called the Belousov-Zabotinsky reaction.
What is one of those?
Well, oscillating reactions are a class of reactions that are often used in chemical demonstrations because they generally change colour and they'll flip from one colour and back again several times. And that's down to the intricate interplay of several reactions that are all going on at the same time within that mixture.
So these kids in school, they're setting this up, and what happened?
OK, so they set up lots of different experiments with different starting concentrations of reagents, and most of those combinations will oscillate for a certain amount of time and then stop, and that'll be it. You've reached a kind of thermodynamic equilibrium. But they did find that at a certain concentration of starting reagents, the reactions would oscillate for about 10 hours or so, and then they would stop for a period of somewhere between 5 and 20 hours, and then they would restart oscillating again, admittedly at a slightly lower rate and whatever. But the crucial thing is that they restart, which means that they haven't got to this thermodynamic equilibrium. They've reached some kind of kinetic trap.
Or something else has changed in the products, maybe an inhibitor or something else that was previously not there, but which appears over time because there's some kind of rate-limiting step in the appearance of another chemical, a derivative of one of the products that takes time to produce, and that then rekindles the reaction.
Well, exactly, Chris. I mean, the reaction that they were doing changes from red to blue, and then it goes yellow in this dormant period, so there's obviously something else there going on, and then it'll go back to the red-blue oscillation until it finally reaches its thermodynamic equilibrium.
And they've published this?
Yeah, it's published in the Journal of Physical Chemistry A.
How are they going to take this forward to try and find out what those products are? Because that can't be easy, because in these tubes you're going to have a mixture of loads of different chemicals, and trying to freeze frame it there, I'm going to find out what is driving the reaction at this point, that can't be terribly easy to do.
Yes, I think, I mean, you're probably going to have to hand that on to someone with a bit more serious spectroscopic kit. But the discovery is, you know, it's one of those things, you know, if you continue to observe, then you're going to find things that maybe other people haven't.
Phil Broadwith. And a tool that might come in handy for that team in Japan is ChemSpider, a massive free database containing the details of over 26 million chemical compounds. It's supported by the Royal Society of Chemistry and it's stewarded by the RSC's Vice President for Strategic Development, Anthony Williams. He talked me through what it's designed to do.
Scientists have gotten so used now to querying the web for information that they're interested in. For example, I have a chemical name and I would like to find out what the chemical structure might be. I would like to know some of the properties of that compound. Boiling point, melting point, crystal structure. Are there any articles about those chemicals that I'm interested in? So when people are seeking information about chemicals, it can be very diverse in nature, but it's commonly information that's been put into other database systems, extracted from literature articles, etc., etc. As with most queries that you make on the web, you can pretty easily get responses. Unfortunately, you get many responses. It can be hundreds, thousands, millions of hits based on a simple query. And the question is how to get from your simple query out to the answer that you might be searching for.
Hasn't this problem already been solved, though, by people who are doing molecular biology? Because if you look at them, they are generating billions of genetic letters every year that get added to databases, and scientists all over the world read those gene codes and use them to inform their research. And surely this is very, very similar, isn't it?
Biology data, certainly there's been a lot of investments in bioinformatics. A lot of grants have been put into this. There's been a lot of public domain systems that have been built and released. Not so much for chemistry, however. There really hasn't been as much effort put into it. A lot of the public domain data that one would expect to have been released a lot sooner didn't really start coming online until efforts such as PubChem. So the bioinformatics world has really led the way, and we're actually in catch-up mode. Small molecules have got a big issue in terms of the detail that is encoded into the way a molecule is represented, the number of synonyms a particular chemical can be labeled as. It's become very, very mixed in terms of quality in a different way than bioinformatics, because they've actually set up systems online that are highly curated that the community has been working together on, not so much for chemistry.
But I'm slightly struggling to understand why an organisation, for instance, as powerful as the Royal Society of Chemistry, which connects chemists worldwide, internationally, and some of the top chemists, why there isn't a consensus like there is for biology to solve this problem. If chemists can solve the kinds of problems that they do routinely, why can't they solve this one?
I think a lot of it is participation. So I judge that most of this is no longer a technology issue. It is getting a community of chemists to participate in aggregating data together, to making it available, to sharing it. If you think about the majority of chemicals that are available today from the life sciences world, of course, many of these can be billion-dollar drugs. Universities are funded by organizations today to do research into small molecules that could end up being patented, could be worth an absolute fortune. So a lot of this information is actually held back. It's not so easily shared by the organizations themselves, certainly in academia. They protect a lot of their information. It's only with some of the shifts that we're seeing in the community now into things like open notebook science and the more willingness from some of the academics to do so, that's when we're going to see the changes coming.
So can you talk us through actually what ChemSpider is, what its strengths are, and how it will actually achieve some of these goals?
ChemSpider at present is a database of organic molecules primarily. It contains 26 million unique chemicals. It's been aggregated from over 400 data sources on the web, from people contributing data to us, depositing data. It's a crowdsourced system, but we've also done a lot of work ourselves to aggregate data. So, for example, you as a scientist may come to the site, you may register, and you could put in any chemical that you are interested in exposing to the public. You could deposit it yourself. It would show up almost immediately. In the background, the Royal Society of Chemistry is taking chemistry out of our articles and sharing it online, making it available. We're working with a number of collaborators to gather their data together. Once we have data online, one of the issues we run into is the diversity of quality from all of these different data sets, because not every organization is focused on the issues of quality. So we've provided an environment for cleaning the data, for annotating it, for curating it, to improve the data quality for everybody.
Now, what about funding, though? Because I know that with a lot of initiatives where there is a database involved, there was initially huge enthusiasm about getting a database set up. But as Jimmy Wales has found with Wikipedia, there's enormous momentum to start with. Keeping it running and keeping that momentum up, though, is another problem. So how do you sustain this?
The Royal Society of Chemistry actually is putting money into the system with our own finances to develop a platform for the community. We do license access to the content to other groups who would like to use it. We license access to services that utilize the database directly. The Royal Society of Chemistry is actually a charity. So we have a publishing arm, but we're also a charity. So we see this as a big part of giving back to the community, and we will continue to fund it. We are involved in grants where we are being funded directly to enhance and develop the system and allow integrations into it that benefit other informatics platforms that are being built. Specifically, there's a project right now called Open Facts that is part of the Innovative Medicines Initiative out of Europe.
And what are your stakeholders, I suppose the end users you're targeting, what do they think of this?
We've had a lot of very positive feedback. We have a much larger development team than ever. We've got thousands and thousands of users hitting us every day now. A lot of the Royal Society of Chemistry's resources are starting to piece more and more into ChemSpider also. We're now hosting reactions. We're rolling out a spectral database capability early next year. We're now supporting the Learn Chemistry initiative, which is for secondary schools. It's just an enormous project that continues to expand in scope.
Anthony Williams, and you can find out more about ChemSpider online at chemspider.com. And now from spiders to crabs. Laura.
So this is some brilliant research out of Japan where they've actually made a crab shell transparent.
Is this part of the Japanese obsession with seafood, or is there another application to this?
Well, I think it's a little more interesting than that. So this is research out of Kyoto University where they're looking at making bio-nanocomposites. So people are looking at using biomaterials into putting them into composite materials to use the strength and the properties of the biomaterial, but combining it with other things and being able to control various sort of mechanical and physical properties.
So the crab shell was a convenient scaffolding or a convenient material to test out?
Precisely. So one of the main things that crab shells are made out of is chitin, which is quite a well-known material. And people want to try and make composites using chitin. So the researchers took a crab shell, whacked it in some acid and some alcohol and cleaned off everything until all they were left with was the chitin. And then they just put it in an acrylic resin monomer. So just soaked it in and pulled it out, polymerised it. And what happened was as the polymerisation happened, the whole thing became transparent. So you've got this material that is strong but also transparent, which is...
Why is the chitin transparent in the acrylic? Is the refractive index the same in the two materials then, so the light just goes straight through?
It's to do with the fact that as long as there's not too much of the chitin around, then it doesn't actually affect the refractive index of the plastic. So it's not so much that the chitin is transparent, because if you look at the chitin shell on its own, then that's kind of opaque. But once you fill it with the resin and fill the whole scaffold, it becomes transparent.
What are the applications of this? Could you then basically make something else out of chitin in a structure you did want and then use this trick to produce an acrylic replica which is see-through, transparent? So you could have all kinds of interesting optical waveguides or so on.
Precisely. And in fact, they then did powder up the chitin and make it into sheets and show that, again, they could make the same sort of material. They've shown that it's... this new composite has quite good optical properties, even up to sort of 80 degrees centigrade. So similar composites that people are making start to lose their optical properties around 60, 65 degrees centigrade. So this is an improvement, which means for various sort of applications, this could be much better.
OK, just going to show crabs are very, very useful. Phil, tell us now about this interesting story, which is very, very small compared with the crab. This is molecules that behave in a polar way, even though they're made of two of exactly the same thing.
Yes, Chris, and according to the kind of standard way of thinking, that doesn't really work. If you've got a molecule that's made of two atoms of the same element, there's no difference in polarity, no difference in electronegativity between those two atoms, so there should be absolutely no electric dipole across them. But what Hossein Sadegpour at Harvard University and a couple of other groups in Germany have done is to take two atoms of rubidium and make a very special kind of molecule that actually does have a dipole.
Why? And how do you do that?
OK, well, I mentioned it as a special molecule. It's a very special molecule. It's called a Rydberg molecule, and it's called that because one of the atoms of rubidium is in what's called a Rydberg state. This is a very highly excited electronic state. It's almost on the point of being ionised, but because it's kept very cold, you can keep that electron just attached to the atom and combine it with another atom that's just a normal rubidium atom to make this crazy molecule, which is about 1,000 times larger than a normal molecule, but will hold itself together for long enough to do some spectroscopy.
So you have one which has got this highly excited electron, another one which has got a normal electronic configuration, and because you've got that asymmetry, you've effectively got this polar behaviour.
Well, it's not even as simple as that, Chris. The prediction for these molecules in the state that that the team have looked at is that they would be perfectly symmetrical electronically. They would not have a dipole. There is a different state that has been predicted to be accessed, which has a very large dipole of something like thousands of debye, compared to this, which is only one debye, and that's about the same as normal organic molecules are normally about one or two debye. Sodium chloride in the gas state's about 10 debye, so just to give you an idea. But this other state that has been predicted, which is called a trilobite state, because if you look at the electron density distribution in the molecule, it resembles one of those fossils that you see, the trilobites. But a little bit of that state has mixed in with the spherically symmetrical state, and that gives it just enough asymmetry to give you this dipole. It's a permanent dipole.
And it doesn't equalise across the molecule, I presume, because the electrons, owing to quantum rules, can only occupy certain energy levels, so it's not trivial for it to just share out the extra energy symmetrically amongst the two.
Yes, Chris, there's no way, according to quantum mechanics, that the electron can transition between the two different states.
And how long does this stuff hang around for? How many picoseconds does it exist for?
It's about 7 microseconds.
Gosh, as long as that?
Yeah. Just long enough to do some spectroscopy.
So what are the practical applications, if any, of this? Is it just academic, or is this actually informing useful chemistry?
It's mostly kind of theoretical and fundamental chemistry and physics of matter. But the interesting thing about this is, because the team has discovered that these two states are ever so slightly mixed, it's possible that this will give you a way to access the proper trilobite state, which has a very, very large dipole, which then gives you some very interesting things to do with the physics of matter.
But given that polar things behave differently to non-polar things, couldn't you use this as a sort of trick way of getting certain molecules to have transient properties and do some interesting chemistry while they had that state, and therefore make some reactions happen that otherwise wouldn't?
Yes, that's entirely possible, Chris. The problem is that they have to be really, really cold and confined on a surface.
But, so the reaction rate would be really low anyway.
Yes, it wouldn't be the easiest thing in the world to do.
Damn, I thought I was onto something there. Thank you, Phil. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, why soot holds the key to clean windows and the lightest metal structure ever made. First, though, to armaments and weapons. You wouldn't assume that making them environmentally friendly would be at the top of the military agenda, but it's something that US chemist Jesse Sabatini deserves a medal for. By replacing the toxic perchlorate oxidising agents in flares with harmless nitrogen-rich organic compounds, he's come up with something that's not only greener, but better too.
I'm an organic chemist by training. And so, you know, what we're finding is in pyrotechnics, it's traditionally an inorganic-based field, but they're starting to use organic chemicals more and more to address some of these environmental hazards. And, you know, I guess the environmental remediation efforts have been ongoing now for at least a decade, actually, at least with the U.S. Army.
What was the big driver? Why do you think they initiated this stance on the environment? Because, forgive me, but the US isn't known for its concern for the environment in many regards. So why the military?
There's two reasons. Number one, the old days of doing research in energetic materials was you just slapped something together, you made sure that it met a specification that the military wanted, and you used it. There really wasn't any thought into the environmental ramifications at that time. Now, we know a lot more about the science and about what chemicals are hazardous, what is dangerous. You know, we do try to be good stewards of the land, and we want to try and reformulate these things. There's also a lot of regulatory pressure from the Environmental Protection Agency and some environmental groups. The big example that I'll tell anybody is the perchlorate issue. Ammonium perchlorate and potassium perchlorate are probably the two biggest ones today that the EPA is really looking to regulate. They have passed a permissible limit of 15 ppb, parts per billion, of potassium perchlorate or ammonium perchlorate that is allowed to be in groundwater.
What are the risks of that chemical being in the groundwater?
A, it contaminates public drinking supplies, but B, the iodide anion and the perchlorate polyatomic ion have roughly the same atomic radius. And because of that, you end up getting a competition that goes on in which iodide and perchlorate compete with binding of the thyroid gland. And if that occurs, then the theory is you're disrupting the proper functioning of the thyroid gland, and it can cause health complications. Now, what's interesting is, you know, a lot of pyrotechnics, for example, contain potassium perchlorate, some of them in very large amounts. A lot of our training simulators, which are used to prepare soldiers for battle, contain a lot of potassium perchlorate. And what happened is when the EPA came out and cracked down on the perchlorates and established the permissible limit at 15 ppb, soldiers were unable to train with perchlorate-containing items on some of these training sites in the United States.
I suppose there's also the chance that the fact that the EPA and other regulators are imposing limits on people and making us have a rethink about many of these things, that we may actually discover better ones, because we stop just using the same old technology. It forces us to think originally and up pop new inventions that turn out to be much superior.
Yeah, and I think you make a very good point there. The initial formulation development that we have done here have done exactly what you have alluded to. We've taken out perchlorates. We've reformulated some of these formulations, like, for example, some handheld signal formulations that I've been doing using these high nitrogen compounds as perchlorate replacements. These things just give away nitrogen gas. It's benign. And we're getting longer burn times. We're getting brighter outputs in terms of, you know, how bright does this thing actually burn, or how bright is this thing to the viewer? And that has good impacts, not only to the military in the field, but also the civilian fireworks sector, I suppose, could also benefit from this as well. And we're also finding that the sensitivities of these, what is the sensitivity to impact or friction or electrostatic discharge, is also lower when we're taking out the perchlorate. And that too is important when you start talking about the safety and handling of these materials.
What is the chemistry behind this, though? What have you had to do in order to make these quite dramatic changes?
It wasn't just the perchlorate that was bad. It was also the binder system that we use. The purpose of a binder is to prevent the segregation of oxidizers and fuels. And the current binder that was used was Laminac binder. It's a polyester binder that is a single point failure. It's only available through one company in the United States. So the first thing we had to do was to introduce a new binder system that was widely available commercially, and one that was also viewed as being non-toxic. And we did. We replaced the Laminac binder with an epoxy-based binder system that was proven to be not environmentally hazardous or not toxic in its polymerized form. Of course, taking out the perchlorates, well, we had decided to go the high nitrogen route. And the reason why is because when you take perchlorate out of a pyrotechnic munition, you lose energy, because perchlorates tend to decompose exothermically. But we knew that most of the energy from the high nitrogen compounds that we were using is based off of its high heat of formation, its copious nitrogen gas release. And then we had to do some modification of burn times and luminous intensity. So we had to prolong the burn time. And the way we did that is we eliminated the fine magnesium powder and went all to the coarse magnesium powder. And so, you know, we were really able to take advantage of several parameters, coarser particle sizes burning longer, of course. High nitrogen compounds gave you a faster burn rate, but epoxy binders burn much longer than Laminac binders. And so I think it was really interdisciplinary chemistry at its finest.
Jesse Sabatini talking to me from Picatinny Arsenal in New Jersey. And now from military flares to candles. Laura.
Okay, so if you're all the way up on a big skyscraper, it's a bit difficult to clean the windows. So people are trying to make self-cleaning glass, which is both super hydrophobic, and also super oleophobic, so it's also very repellent for oil. Doris Vollmer and colleagues at the Max Planck Institute for Polymer Research in Germany has decided to use candle soot to make their coating.
Okay. Sounds like a rather strange approach. Why have they done that?
It does sound like a bit of a strange sort of approach. We know that candle soot is black and horrible, and, you know, but it's also known that candle soot is super hydrophobic, so water is easily repelled and rolls off the surface.
Yes, indeed. If you coat a surface with it and then drip water onto it, the water beads into lots of little bubbles
exactly.
and runs off.
Exactly, and then it rolls off. But obviously, soot is also not very strong. So as the water rolls off, it takes some of the soot with it, and eventually...
It's also impractical to hold all of the panes of glass of your block of flats.
Well, for two reasons. I mean, you don't want to make a factory full of candles, and neither do you want your windows covered in soot.
Because you wouldn't see through them.
Exactly.
OK, so how do they do it then?
They literally get a candle, light it, put a piece of glass over it, and voila, you've got a coating that's super hydrophobic. What they then did, though, was they then used chemical vapour deposition to just cover those soot particles with some more silica.
Ah, so you're making a sort of glass sandwich. You have glass, the soot particles, and then you're putting more silica, the raw material of glass, on top to sandwich the soot in between.
Exactly. But at that point, it's still not see-through. What they then did was calcined it. So they basically heated it up to about 200 degrees to burn off the candle soot, because obviously candle soot is carbon that hasn't quite been combusted into carbon dioxide and water.
And that can get out through the second layer of silica deposited on top.
There's enough of a gap that it can escape and leave behind a transparent layer of these silica particles in the shape of the candle soot particles that they were cast onto.
So the silica that's deposited takes on the shape of the soot that was there, even though the soot is no longer there.
It's exactly
fixed in the silica.
It's all in the shape. So this is similar to some of the super hydrophobic surfaces that people have, where you've got sort of tiny pillars and that uses surface tension to stop the water from joining. But what they've shown is that not only is it super hydrophobic, it's also super oleophobic. It repels oil as well.
Is this achievable on a mass manufacturing scale?
Well, when I spoke to Doris Vollmer, she said that it wasn't really so much for achieving it on a mass scale, although potentially you could. If you think about what they've actually done, they've got a candle, they've done a bit of vapour deposition, and then they've calcined it, which is basically like putting it in an oven. So, I mean, it's only a step up from something you could do in your kitchen at home.
That's amazing stuff. Well, let's find out actually about another interesting micro material in terms of microfabrication and ultrastructure. What have you got, Patrick?
So what I have here is a story about the lightest material ever constructed.
Lighter even than the infamous aerogel.
Yes, so aerogels are gels that have been denuded of all their water, so this leaves just behind a skeleton behind. But this metallic structure is actually 10% lighter than the lightest aerogels, so it really is incredibly light material, and the researchers have a great picture on it, which you can see on our website, which is quite a large piece of the material resting on top of the head of a dandelion.
And this is not just the head as in the bit where the stalk ends. This is those fluffy little seeds that the dandelion clock
exactly,
and it's resting on those. So this really is seriously light.
Mm.
How do they make it, and who's done this?
Right, so Tobias Schaedler at HRL Labs in Malibu and colleagues from other universities put it together by using a UV mask. The mask is able to direct UV light in specific ways and directions. And what they did is they used a monomer solution. And then by shining the UV light through this mask, they were able to polymerize the solution. So the solution's only polymerized where the UV light is going.
So you get a sort of three-dimensional...
Exactly, effect. Yeah. And this is helped in part by the fact that as the UV light is doing its job and polymerising the monomers, the polymer that's forming then acts as a guide that guides the UV light further into the solution.
Oh, that's clever. So the mask doesn't have to work in three dimensions, because once you've got an initial, a spider's web of the polymer, it then in turn starts absorbing and allowing to pass through another area is more UV light, so you get a repetition.
It's a self-propagating waveguide.
So that gives you the monomer polymerised. So that's some kind of organic thing, some polymer. How do you then get to the metallic bit of it?
So what they've created there is a polymer mould. So it's like casting a brass statue, perhaps. So what they then do is they dip this mould into a catalyst solution and then take it out, dip it into another solution, this time a nickel phosphorus solution. So in the nickel phosphorus solution, the catalyst that's left over catalyses the formation of this nickel phosphorus structure. So this metal structure is deposited in a micro-lattice way.
All around the original
exactly.
polymer.
Exactly. So you're left with these tiny, tiny tubes. They're 100 micrometres in diameter, and the walls of them are only 100 nanometres thick. They're incredibly light and have extremely low density. So they're 99.99% air, and they're just 0.9 milligrams per cubic centimetre. but the structural properties are quite impressive. So if you compress the microlattice down to half its size, it springs back with hardly any damage, which is in complete contrast to the bulk alloy structure, which is very brittle and breaks.
So what do you think you could do with this?
It looks like there could be loads of possible uses for it. I mean, things like shock absorption or perhaps soundproofing. It could also be a structural material. I mean, they talk about use in aircrafts because it's so light.
Thanks, Patrick. And that picture of a piece of the metal perched on a fluffy dandelion head really is stunning. Take a look by searching the Chemistry World website for metal microlattice if you want to find it. Now, if all of this has been enough to make your head hurt, Phil's back with another cause for brain pain.
OK, Chris, well, given the time of year, we thought we'd ask what you thought was the cause of a hangover.
Well, too much whiskey, usually.
Well, yes, Chris, but that's the kind of symptomatic cause. But in terms of chemistry, what is it? People say it's dehydration or it's acetaldehyde or it's various other chemicals within the congeners within the different alcoholic drinks.
So, definitely true. If you buy decent wine, it doesn't have too many negative effects. If you buy cheap stuff, it does. And if you drink whiskey on top of a load of that wine, it definitely produces very deleterious effects.
Well, yes, Chris, and there's various research has been done, and I think it's mostly likely to be a combination of all of those factors. But it's certainly true that if you stick to something like vodka, which has been triple distilled and then filtered to get rid of precisely those congeners, you might not feel quite so
queasy.
Although we would encourage all listeners of the podcast to drink responsibly over New Year.
Indeed. So putting it all together, basically, there are things that are already in the drink which are bad when you consume it, so they're toxins that accumulate. There are also metabolic derivatives, acetaldehyde, so when you break down ethanol, you make that, and then other chemicals that are made in an onward breakdown from that. There's also the dehydrating effect, so it's everything coming together.
Yeah, it's a kind of perfect storm to make you feel absolutely horrible.
Sink a couple of paracetamol, acetaminophen for our American listeners, and a couple of pints of water, and you wake up in the morning and you don't have half as many symptoms. Is that an evidence-based practice?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to be any kind of expert, but there is a certain amount of evidence that several of these chemicals are inflammatory, so having something like an anti-inflammatory drug might help. I think the water will not do you any harm either.
I think that's what they call wisdom in hindsight. That is it for this month. Thank you to our guests, Anthony Williams and Jesse Sabatini, and also our regulars, Phil Broadwith, Laura Howes and Patrick Walter. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. Best wishes for a prosperous 2012, and until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.